Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live as usual this Monday morning. I think it's January 28th, if I'm not mistaken. And we have a half hour together, which seems to go by extremely quickly. It's a very short time together, but it's a live time, interactive time. You can call in during this half hour if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith. We can talk about them here, and you don't have to be calling as a Christian. That is, you don't have to be a Christian with questions. You could be a person who's not a Christian and has questions about the Christian faith or about the Bible. Maybe even objections to Christianity. Feel free to give me a call. I'd be glad to talk to you in any case if you have a difference of opinion or if you simply have curiosity. The number is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Our first caller today is Sandy from San Jose, California. Sandy, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. My family and I are going are in BSF. We've been in for a number of years, and we're going through the study of Genesis, which is always new and great things to learn. My question specifically is, in Genesis 12:10, thereabouts, Abraham lied to Pharaoh about his wife, said it was his sister, so that he wouldn't be killed. And then again he does it in Genesis 20, except in this case, he actually gets blessed for lying and gets to leave with stuff. And the question that came up last night, it was a BSF question, which I didn't quite know how to handle, was, so what happens when a person lies, right? Well, in this case, he got blessed. So my question is, this is just a strange one. I don't quite know. I mean, he clearly did something wrong, and clearly both guys were warned, you know, don't touch this guy's wife. But why did Abraham walk away scot-free, and not only scot-free, why did he get blessed? And how do I explain that to my kids?
Well, to say he got blessed is simply to say that Abimelech gave him a lot of riches.
Right.
And I think that Abimelech may have done so sort of to atone for the wrong that Abimelech had done wrongfully. He had taken Abram's wife. Of course, it was Abraham's fault.
Right.
In a sense that Abraham had lied. But on the other hand, it remained the case that Abimelech had taken another man's wife. And one could argue he should have done more research or whatever. But the point is, regardless of Abraham's fault, Abimelech had done something that was a moral or social faux pas. And obviously, he was seeking to sort of make that right, although it wasn't entirely his fault.
Well, that's it. You know, he said, this is my sister. So it's like, okay, it's your sister. She's pretty. I like her. You know, let's go have some fun. You know, I mean, I don't quite see the
right
sin that Pharaoh did. I really don't, or Abimelech, either case.
Well, I don't know that they did sin, but they ended up doing something ignorantly that was wrong.
Okay.
That is taking
right
another man's wife. You know, I mean, even in the Jewish law, there were sacrifices that had to be offered for sins of ignorance that people later would realize they had done. Mm-hmm. The fact that you sinned ignorantly might mean that you're not as culpable, but it doesn't mean that the deed was not done, and the deed was a wrong deed. So, I mean, I think he's just making it right. He's not vindicating Abraham, and I don't know that we're even supposed to see this as an instance of God blessing Abraham. It's just in the course of settling this matter, Abimelech, I think perhaps to relieve his own conscience about having had another man's wife in his home, even though he had done it ignorantly, once he realized it, it was a ghastly thing. You know, I think he was just trying to make sure that Abraham wouldn't have any claims against him by just lavishing lots of stuff on him. Now, that people sometimes get what you might call blessed, if we don't mean that by, you know, God's favor, but we just mean that by advantages or good fortune comes upon them when they sin, well, this would not be the only time. I mean, many times very wicked people are very wealthy, and sometimes they get wealthy by sinning, by exploiting other people or by cheating. And some of the wealthiest people in the world probably are in that category. You know, I don't know that we'd say they are blessed by God with all their wealth, but it looks like they are. I mean, they look like blessed people because they've got everything going for them, and yet they've gotten everything they got through deception. This story is not teaching that God blesses lying, but it's just a realistic story about how sometimes, even though you do the wrong thing, you don't get nailed for it. Abraham got nailed for it a little bit. He got taken to task. He was publicly humiliated.
Right.
But as far as the financial gain that he got from Abimelech, I don't think that would be seen as, a mark of God's favor on Abraham for that. Though, of course, God's favor on Abraham is something that was pretty much, undeserved anyway. You know, Abraham believed God, and that was counted to him for righteousness. And so his righteous standing with God was based on his believing in God, not on his being a perfect man.
So this is in one of those areas where it's sort of descriptive but not prescriptive. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? In other words,
it's definitely. It's just telling a story. Not every story is an example for us. I mean, when David slept with Bathsheba and got away with it, that doesn't mean that it's okay to sleep with your neighbor's wife.
But in this case,
story that happened.
In this case, Abraham got away with it. But I hear what you're saying, and we try to teach our kids. I think too much in the Christian world, not always, but too much. People will say, the enemy is robbing me of whatever, it's the attack of the enemy, when many times, not always, people are in sin, and that's when God will judge. Of course, he doesn't always judge the sin immediately, so I think in this case it was a little bit sort of, it was hard to explain, but I get it. That's sort of a good explanation. Doesn't always, he may not have been blessed by God, he just kind of got away with it, God's favor was on him as he afflicted Pharaoh. So that's cool.
The stories in the Old Testament are not necessarily always moral tales or parables or anything like that. They just tell us about the real life of real people. And parallels to this, where a man does something deceptive, even if he's a preacher, even if he's a so-called man of God, and he does something illegal or he does something dishonest, he might profit temporally for it. He might make some money in a bad, dirty deal. That's not a good thing. Christians shouldn't do that. And there's things that Abraham shouldn't have done. But that doesn't mean that the profit that came to him from it was, the mark of God's approval on his behavior.
Okay. Yeah, okay. And I guess
think too many times Christians view prosperity as the blessing of God and poverty or financial difficulty as a sign of God's disfavor. Of course, the prosperity doctrine in the Word of Faith teaching has encouraged that kind of mentality, but Jesus taught almost the opposite. Jesus said, "Blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Woe to you rich, for you have received your reward." So certainly Jesus did not indicate that it's correct to think of financial blessing as a picture of God's favor upon you.
And if anything, it can become a curse because the wealth itself becomes your God. And so it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom than, I'm sorry.
Than for a camel to go by a needle. Yeah.
Right. Well, one last point, I'll leave. This is from Fiddler on the Roof. It's not scriptural, but it sure is pretty funny. The line where Tevye says, it's no shame to be a poor person, but it's no great honor either. I mean, it's kind of funny. It was
well
a line.
Put.
Of, sorry?
Well put.
Yeah, that's Tevye. So anyway. Okay, Steve, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time today.
All right. God bless you.
You too.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
I just saw Fiddler on the Roof again last week, so that I remember that line very well, as well as that guy who always said well put whenever he said something he liked. Let's talk next to Mel from Inglewood, California. Mel, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. Good morning. I have a question about the pastors who are ladies or women.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
We had a Bible study group, and a visiting pastor taught about women in pastors are not biblical. And the pastor who was also in our group said that that's wrong. I was wondering if What's your take on that?
If we say that for a woman to be a pastor, that is unbiblical. That's simply a statement of fact. That's not necessarily a criticism of women or anything like that. It's just a fact that the Bible does not have any instance of female pastors. Now, however, the Bible doesn't have any examples of male pastors either. The idea of a pastor of a church didn't arise in biblical times. It arose later on. It seems like the earliest documentation we have for an individual man pastoring a church is in the writings of Ignatius in the second century. In the New Testament times, they didn't have a man called a pastor or a woman called a pastor. They had what they called elders or overseers. And as near as we can tell from Scripture, each church had a group of elders, a group of overseers. And these did the pastoral work. So in a sense, each of the elders was like a pastor or shepherd, because the elders were told to shepherd the church of God in Acts 20, verse 28, and also over in 1 Peter chapter 5, I think it's around verse 4 or 3 maybe. In any case, the elders were all men. And the elders in the New Testament were the closest thing we have as a parallel to pastors today. So if we would say that a pastor must be qualified on the biblical basis as an elder, because the Bible does give qualifications for an elder in 1 Timothy 3 and in Titus chapter 1, it's very clear that an elder, for example, has to be the husband of one wife. Well, obviously, a husband is always a man. And Paul did say in 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 12 through 15, he said that he did not permit women to be in those leadership roles, the eldership roles. And so the idea that women would be elders would be not really something you'd find in the biblical times.
Okay, so to what extent can a woman have a leadership in the church?
There's all kinds of ministries that people can do. For example, I'm not an elder in a church, but I'm in full-time ministry. There's lots of full-time ministry people can do without being an elder or without being a pastor. Women, for example, according to Titus chapter 2, it says that the older women should teach the younger women how to be, godly women. And Titus 2, verses 2 through 4, actually lines out the curriculum of what older women should teach younger women. So obviously a woman who can teach should teach, but she should teach those that she's supposed to teach, and she's not supposed to be necessarily the pastor of the church, but she can teach other women. She can certainly teach children, because Timothy, we are told, was taught the scriptures by his mother and his grandmother. And Paul said that was a great thing. Paul was really excited about Lois and the grandmother of Timothy teaching him the scripture from his youth. So for a woman to teach children, for a woman to teach women, is never in any way forbidden, and is apparently something that's good. Now, on the other hand, there are times when women can teach men also in certain situations. For example, in Acts chapter 18, Priscilla and Aquila, a wife and her husband together, took Apollos aside and corrected him about some of his theology. His doctrine was not quite adequate, and so they, a married couple, of which the impression is given that the wife is the leading spokesperson because she's named first, Priscilla and Aquila, that's the wife and the husband, took Apollos aside and taught him more perfectly the ways of God. So we have here a woman participating in teaching not only a man, but teaching a public minister, Apollos, but she was not an elder in the church. See, so a person doesn't have to be an elder in order to be in the ministry. There's lots of ministries. In fact, Paul mentions apostles and prophets and evangelists and pastors and teachers, and there's ministries of mercy and giving and helps and administration. There's a lot of different gifts, and women might have any of those gifts. But the only thing we know of that Paul kept women from was positions where they were having authority over the whole congregation, over the particularly over the men of the church.
Okay. I get it. Thanks. Thanks, Steve.
Okay, Mel. Thanks for your call. Good talking to you.
All right. Thank you.
Bye now. All right. Our next caller is Mike from Garden Grove, California. Mike, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. My question is in Acts chapter 2, verse 44. So it says the disciples, early church, they had sold all their possessions and they had things in common. My question is, why isn't that done today? And if it is, there are groups that do that, because I know there have been called, you know, it's a cult, they're cultic, or, and there's this one pastor teacher on the radio who I won't mention. In his commentary, he says that the early church doing this was absolutely wrong. It was a mistake. So.
Well, we do read twice in the book of Acts, in chapter 2 and in chapter 4, that there was none of the believers who considered that what they had was their own, but they, as it says, as everyone had lands and such, it says they were selling them and dividing them among the people as people had need. It says in verse 44 of Acts 2, now all who believed were together and had all things in common and sold their possessions and goods and divided them among all as any had need. And you have the same information pretty much about the church in Acts chapter 4, verse 32. Now the multitude of those who believed were of one heart, one soul. Neither did anyone say that any of the things that he possessed was his own, but they had
right.
all things common.
Right.
And it says, nor was there anyone who lacked among them, for all who were possessors of lands and houses were selling them and brought the proceeds of the things that were sold and laid them at the apostles' feet, and they distributed them as anyone had need. Now, the impression is given, perhaps, that when people would join the church, they'd immediately liquidate their possessions, bring the proceeds to the apostles, and then they'd be divided up in sort of a, almost a communistic way, you know,
right.
to everybody.
Right.
And so many people have understood that way, and some people have thought that was a mistake they made, although Luke doesn't say it was a mistake that they made, nor does he actually indicate anything negative about it. He says there was no one among them that had need because of this arrangement. That certainly sounds like a good result. A desirable result is that no one in the church should have any unmet needs. So if Luke gives any indication of whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, it certainly it sounds like he thought it was a good thing because this policy resulted in no one lacking anything they needed. And that would be a good society to be in, where
right.
there was no one lacking what they needed. So I don't think it was a bad thing, but I will say this, that the tense of the verbs in these verses might be possibly misconstrued. Because it says in, like, the New King James, it says they sold their possessions and divided them. And in the Greek it says they were selling them and dividing them. And this is a process. It's not like someone got saved and immediately signed over the deed to his house to the apostles or something like that. It's rather that they were in the habit of selling things they had to give to the poor as anyone had need. There's both of the passages speak about as anyone had need. So what I think was happening, and of course I could be wrong, but this is at least a possibility from the way the text reads. In the church, there was such a common heart. It says they were all of one heart and one soul. That they considered that they were all brothers. If anyone suffered, all suffered. If anyone was lacking, then all are lacking. They all bore one another those burdens and so fulfilled the law of Christ, as Galatians says. And what I think was going on is as needs arose, or because both passages say as anyone had need, when needs arose, those who had things that they didn't need sold them and brought them to be distributed to the needy.
Could it be like sold their excess if you had, you know, two or three or four? So could it possibly mean that they didn't sell everything but like the excess they had? Or?
Yes. Yes, it could easily mean that. As you know, people who had houses and lands, that could be people who had multiple houses and multiple
right.
lands and,
right.
and that they were selling off stuff to help each other. In other words, instead of accumulating extra stuff that they didn't need
right,
for themselves,
right.
they were selling those things as needs arose. and distributing them. So it might not be that they had, it certainly was not an enforced thing, because we find in chapter 5 that when Ananias and Sapphira sold land and they didn't bring all of it to give away, but they pretended like they were doing so. They were rebuked for lying. They were rebuked for their hypocrisy. But they were told that they had no obligation to have sold their house in the first place or their land. And that Peter told them, when it was yours to keep or sell. And when you sold it, the money was yours. In other words, he's basically saying, you didn't have to do this at all. So why did you pretend that you're doing it to, make a name for yourself and lie to us about it? So they were rebuked really for their hypocrisy, because they were pretending to be generous. But the thing that they had done, the selling of their land, Peter said that was not necessary for them to do. So this was something that was done voluntarily. This is why it was different. I mean, this is one way, at least, it was different than a modern communist government. A modern communist government takes everything from everyone and redistributes it. It's not voluntary.
Right.
And in the Christian church, this was simply the way that love of the brethren manifested itself. Like John said in 1 John, if a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, actually James said this, and John said something similar, but James said, if a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food and you don't give them what they need, how does the love of God, or it says your faith is not right? I guess that is John. 1 John and James both have statements about this, about helping needy people. And if you don't help them, then your faith is without works, it says in James 2, or in 1 Peter 3, or 1 John 3, it says that you don't have the love of God in you. So
what if
it was understood.
What if a church is very large and very prosperous, of millions of dollars, and they preach Jesus all day long and love all day long, and someone comes in hurting and poor, and they say, well, brother, isn't God your father? What's your problem? Don't you have a prayer line with God? Aren't you right with God? Mm-hmm. Where's your faith? And they're being blessed, and they preach. There's a certain church, I won't mention, here in Southern California, probably more than one. They preach the Bible, the Word, on the radio, around the world. But God help you if you're hurting. Maybe they'll help one person out of 10, and the other 9, they'll just we'll pray for you, bro. We'll pray for
you.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the problems with a very large church, is it's hard for them to really know the real needs. I mean, if a person walks into the church and says, I need money to pay my rent, but the church is so large that the leaders don't even know the person, they might think, well...
What if a person had been attending there faithfully for an entire year, every Sunday, and so they knew, they may not have been, close friends, but they knew the person. I mean, they knew the person's face. They knew the person was there.
If they know that the person's need is legitimate, most churches, now I don't know about the church you're referring to, but most churches I've been part of have a benevolence fund, which they use to help families that they know to have legitimate needs. Now, sometimes, it's a little different in our society. I mean, we still need to be helping the poor families in the church, but I think in our society, we have other things going on. For example, there's welfare. Now, I don't think Christians should have to go on welfare. I think the church should provide the welfare for their own members. But because lots of church members probably are on welfare, the church doesn't feel that they need to be burdened with the support of those people. And they figure, well, the government's doing that, perhaps. But there's other times when people, I lived at a church office for a while when I was an elder in a church, and people would come to our door with their alleged needs. They're traveling through town with their family, and they need gas to get to their next place, and they need food. And, we found out that a lot of these people are just scammers. They just go to the churches looking for help. Now, you mentioned a situation where you're known, or someone is known to the church. If that person's needs are known to the church to be legitimate, then the church should help, and they shouldn't be picking on the person, saying, well, you should have more faith. If a church teaches that, having enough money is just having enough faith, frankly, I believe if we're in the will of God, we will have enough, but we may just have food and clothing. That's enough. Paul said, having food and raiment, we should with these things be content. But the problem is, there's a lot of church people with a lot more than that. And it should be the case that if I have a lot more than what I need, and I see a brother who has less than I would want to live on, and they're doing everything they know to do, they're working or they're trying to work, and they're not spending their money on alcohol and drugs and wasteful things, You know, in other words, if their poverty is not their own fault and not the base, not due to something they could change and change that situation right away, then I should be as interested in their comfort as in my own. If I'm not, then I'm not really much of a Christian, because that kind of love, Jesus said, you know that people know you're my disciples if you love like I loved. Well, how did Jesus love us? Well, he gave up everything so that we could have what we needed, and not physically so much, but he provides for that too. So I think there's a lack of love many times in certain churches, where people are quite happy to be comfortable and have their own luxuries, but they're unmindful of other people in the church who have needs. And that's an imbalance. That's definitely not like the early church. And I think we should be more like the early church in that respect, certainly.
Okay, thank you, Steve.
Okay, I appreciate your call, brother. Okay, our next caller is Dave. We don't have very much time, Dave. I'm afraid I don't think we have time to take your call. I wish we did. But I think in about 15 seconds we're going to hear this theme music and then we're going to be done. So, Dave, maybe you can call me tomorrow, because we have the rest of the week, of course. And as for the rest of you, I just have time to really sign off, I think. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We are a daily broadcast, but only a half hour each day, each morning. Some of our listeners hear us at night on a rebroadcast in their area. But it's a morning program live, and we have an afternoon program live also, but you can't hear it on the same stations you're listening to the morning program on. But you can hear both programs at our website, which is thenarrowpath.com. There you'll find lots of resources, all of them free, nothing for sale in this ministry, but free resources by the hundreds, actually. Check it out at the website, thenarrowpath.com. We are a listener-supported ministry. We pay for the time on the radio from listener donations. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless.